Hello and welcome once again to the Oklahoma Atheist Godcast, the digital audio stream where we are casting gods out, broadcasting our doubt, and casting about for answers to difficult questions. Today on the show, we're talking with Jamila Bey. Jamila is a journalist, a comic, a NPR veteran, and so many other things. We spoke with her on a broad range of topics, ranging from sex, politics, to religion, awkward long elevator rides, I mean, basically all the really difficult stuff. I'd like to apologize in advance for the sound quality today. We had some really difficult technical issues. Skype kept dropping off over and over, and eventually we had to go back to using a cell phone. And you can hear that in the sound quality. It's really kind of hard to make out some of what she's saying. But if you can get past that, there's some really great substance to what she has to say, and I would like you to get to hear it. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, so let's see if it works. I'm just really happy because when the phone line dropped, I went, it's not me. It's not me.
It's not you. It's that shitty Oklahoma internet. I don't know. I really have no idea what to say. So tell me everything interesting about yourself. You're a comedian. You're a journalist. You're working on a book.
I am working on a book, and I have to do a Kickstarter. I'm at a point where I need to sequester myself and sit down for a couple of weeks and just write. I've got all the research. I've got my interviews. I just need to write, and that's not my life and my beautiful apartment and my friends who know how to reach me and my darling child and my wonderful husband. I'm not doing very well. I need to go somewhere where I can, where I can't really get cell phone reception, so I've got to be near a landline if I want a phone call. And I can just kind of do the writer retreat thing, because that's the only way this thing is going to happen. And on one hand, that makes me kind of sad because it's admitting that I'm too ADD to do what I do, where I'm at. But on the other hand, I'm like, no, writers have always needed to go and do their hermit thing when they're like putting it down. So
yeah,
maybe I'm just a writer. So.
Yeah, you wouldn't be inventing the idea of the author's retreat, it's like a thing.
True. There are many and far better who have paved the way. So
if only you could be an academic, you could get a sabbatical that they send you away.
Oh, sabbatical. I that word it conjures up, Nirvana or something. I don't know. Someday, perhaps. But yeah, I do that. I host my radio show. I will let you know. You are the first to know. I'm about to take my show to 3 days a week, so I'm really looking forward to that. That's going to be pretty exciting for me.
And this is the show that covers all the topics my mom told me never to talk about with people.
That is the very one. Yes, the Sex, Politics, and Religion Hour, Spar with Jamila. I need to do more sparring.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm all about sex, politics, and religion, except when I go to work, I'm not allowed to talk about those things. When you go to work, that's what you do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's funny. Not talking about them certainly hasn't helped the cause much. There are the things that people love to discuss. And every so often I swap out the R in religion for the R that is race.
Ooh.
And, the thing is, these are the issues that hold meaning and hold interest for many, if not most of us. And, I'm polite enough. I mean, I think well. I can ask some good questions, and mine is not the show you come on and just scream until they say time. Mine is the show where if you represent personhood USA, you're going to get tough questions, and if you represent, a group that you know, wants freedom and liberty for people, I'm going to ask you tough questions, too.
Speaking as a relatively sex-positive, relatively liberal, not a Republican atheist in Oklahoma, I try to avoid those three areas of conversation.
Yeah, it's a minefield down here.
Well, you know, it's funny because you never know where your allies are standing. And I can't, well, I will tell you, I won't give names, but I get email, well, not so much email anymore, but I get Facebook messages and I get tweets to people's, you know, three people following them blogs about, you know, I live in the Bible Belt and I am a raging atheist, but nobody knows but me. I've gotten a bunch of Facebook messages that go something like, I am on a scholarship for music at fill in the blank historically black college or university.
Mm-hmm.
And all the music we sing is Jesus, Jesus, Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's driving me crazy. But if I say anything, not only do I lose all my friends, but I'm going to lose my scholarship too. Please keep doing whatever it is that I did that made a bunch of people angry. Please keep doing that because you're not as alone as you think you are. And the thing is, you know, frankly, I think it's we need a better word for blessing, but I think it's the blessing of growing up and being a complete and utter misfit. I had to learn really young that if I'm not the best company there is for me, there's no more hope for me personally. You know, if your friends are way cooler than my friends were, maybe that's not true for you. But really young, I got to be very comfortable in my skin, and I got to be very happy with my own company because that was the only option I had. And so the idea of limiting my speech or modifying my thoughts, or, you know, I'm not a rude person. I am pretty liberal with the swearing and the salty language, but if you invite me to your home, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that in front of children and people who are sensitive to certain expressions.
You're welcome to do that in my home, because that's how the rules that's how the rules are in my living room.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah, my kids know all the bad words, and they know early on not to use them because they hear me say them, and then they see my wife's grimacing, so they know it's like those are the wrong ones. Don't say that; it makes mom angry.
My rule is there are mommy words, and there are words that don't bother other people. And we've had to modify some of the mommy words because I'm going, oh, that's not cute when you say that anymore. We're going to find a different way of saying that. So, I forget the name of the improv game where you say, but the last thing the person said, they have to come up with a new word for. So if you're talking about, oh, well, meet my mom. And then you say I forget there's an actual word for it. But you go, here's my mom, and then your partner says Buzz or whatever it is, and you go, here's my.
It's not taboo.
Third grade teacher, you know. That's it. Thank you. That was bothering me all night. So my kid is pretty good at that game. You know, here's hey, I'm so cute. Swear word. Oh, fiddlesticks, mommy. You know, whatever it is. I probably shouldn't have shared that. Oh well, too late.
It's all good. So your book that you've got the research on and you're going to go tuck yourself away, what's the general subject matter going to be?
This is a critical look at the role religion plays in the lives of African-American women. Statistically speaking, I do not exist.
Mm.
You know, and I won't give away all the research, but I take Pew to task on some of their numbers. They're not specific enough for my case, but anyway, more than 90% of women who look as I do, who are in this country, not only say they believe in God, they say they have a deep relationship with God. The demographic that I speak about, that I belong to, has the lowest net worth of any other demographic that's broken up by gender and race, broken up by gender or race.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a pop quiz. Which demographic group out-ties every other one?
Out-ties? I'm gonna say women of color.
Gotta be specific, because Hispanic women tie pretty well too, but it is African American women.
Damn, I was so close.
There you go. And I'll tell him what he's won, Johnny. You know, I laugh about it, but it is no laughing matter. So, long story short, I've got all this research. I've started to write. I need to be able to take the time from the day job, from the thrice weekly show, and just sit down and write. And I think were I to do that in 30-ish days, I would be ready for an editor better than myself to give me the good twice over and see where we wind up.
Well, I really look forward to seeing how that turns out.
Thank you.
Eventually.
Me too.
So the thrice weekly show, that's the Voice of Russia show that's still going to be happening?
That is the Voice of Russia show, and I rather enjoy that show, and it is a lot of fun. I am a big 12-year-old, and without a drill sergeant or a boss or a child or a husband to say, you must be doing this right now, I tend to work on what's attractive looking to me at the moment. I'm very good at a lot of things, organization and, you know, stick-to-itiveness through all of the projects I've got going. It's kind of hard, so... I'm always looking for a drill sergeant. Yeah.
So is this a show that our Free OK organizer, Kai Teng Crady, was on earlier?
Yes, it was.
You've had a very unique life or working experience than, I would say, other skeptics traveling in this speaker circuit. Can you talk to us about your time in different NPR radio station networks?
I do want to argue a little bit. I think, unlike Barbie, who's done every job and all of hers are totally unrelated, I mean, you know, Barbie the astronaut and then like Malibu Barbie, what do those have to do with each other? My love of the First Amendment and the reporting I do and my whole career path, even when I was still in high school, everything I think led to what I'm doing now and what I'm trying to do, and that is express myself and, you know, express the fact that I love my country because it gives me a First Amendment. In high school, I really came to know and love myself once I started doing debate, once I started doing competitive speaking. That was the thing that, I mean, I'm not saying that I am, you know, I am Van Gogh being given my first brush, but giving me a captive audience and a time limit. I was sold. I was, you know, barely at 13, 14 years old, and it was exactly what I wanted to do. I was in college and needed a job. Walked over to what I thought was the campus radio station. It wound up being the real radio station that just happened to be on campus. And I have always been a political junkie. And I wound up talking about an election that hadn't happened yet, and I called it. It was one of these things where I said the incumbent. I said, the incumbent just gave a speech where he pissed off labor, he pissed off women. It's going to be close. It's going to be 8 points. I had no way of knowing this. It was educated, yes, clearly. The incumbent wound up losing. I got a call. I did that interview maybe like a Thursday. I got a call that Wednesday after the election day, which was Tuesday, And I was told, you'll be in the newsroom. So I was on the air for 2 years before I ever took the journalism course. And I really think that's how it should be. You should have everything you write be ripped apart by a grumbling, smoking,
cursing
misanthrope. Yeah. Well, this guy was really—he was pretty religious, so he didn't curse, but he could give you a look that just made you want to just pack it up and never try again. But a pat on the head was like, manna. It was like, oh yeah, this is what people chase. And I had a few things going for me. I mean, I was already somebody who was trained in debate, which I think everybody should put their kid in, but that's just me. So I knew how to think. I knew how to think on my feet. I knew how to ask good questions, and I knew how to deal with somebody who didn't want to be straight with me, which tends to make me mad, which tends to make me ask you harder and harder questions. Because I like that feeling of being pinned into a corner and there's nowhere to go, and I'm the one who can say yes if or not. That kind of thing lends itself to somebody who wants to be a reporter. The thing is, too, news is all about timing. Comedy is all about timing. Nobody in a newsroom, few people in a newsroom take things that you have one extreme, people take everything so seriously. And then you have the other extreme where everything is a joke and everything is about, well, how can I work it into my story? New people joke a lot. Our jokes are crude, our jokes are crap. And then I had the benefit of being a cop kid. So, like, there's some really, really dark, horrific humor that I didn't realize other families didn't talk about at the dinner table. And so I wound up working at Air America, this new liberal radio network that our friends and people are putting together. And I have proof I was telling people, that Rachel girl, you need to watch her. She is going places.
No kidding.
When Rachel Maddow was just the girl in the glasses who's on the morning show, she was never just that, this is an Oxford scholar, but before she was, the person she is, and the thought leader she is. While I was there, I kept getting the stage as a comedy writer, and I was like, why don't you think I'm a news person? Why do you be telling me that I should go hang out with the comedian? I am a hard news person, damn it. And people okay, fine, whatever. Oh, boy, she's being serious. And so I tried doing stand-up, and I liked it. I mean, it's fun. Until you get into life and limb situations, I would argue there is no harder job, to get in front of a room full of unrelated people who have paid for the privilege of being there, and then you've got to keep them entertained. But more than that, you've got to make them laugh. You've got to make them feel a thing at the same time as the drunk person across the room, or the person in the back of the room, or the guy in the front of the room who's only there to try and take somebody home that night. You've got to get them all in sync with each other and with you, and do it in a way that you can maintain. I mean, it's not just about coming up and doing a knock-knock joke, getting one laugh. I mean, the sustaining of such a thing is really freaking hard. It goes back to, I will say again, high school competitive speaking. Because if you can do it good when you're 14 and having a hostile audience can turn, I'm weird, hostile audiences don't. They kind of intrigue me because I'm like, you're already okay, you're hostile, great, okay, fine, let's work with this, because I'm kind of used to this, the beauty of being an outcast when you're young.
Would you like to arrange a hostile audience at Free OK?
I'd love to.
We could plant some hecklers like easily enough. We could do that for you.
Oh hey, there we go. Hecklers, what? Yeah.
because I heard comedians love those, from what I've heard.
Some do. Some do. it's interesting because, you know, some, like, if you're there, there are some comics who, and I got good enough to realize that I was better at journalism. Doesn't mean that I don't do it on occasion. It just means that, frankly, the mortgage would get paid with me telling news stories as opposed to telling jokes. But there are some comics who do like to do off the cuff, in the moment, very improvisational kind of material.
Yeah.
The one that I'm in love with who did that so well is the late, great Patrice O'Neill. You know, his last album before he died, which was recorded here in Washington, D.C., Mr. P. And there is a bit, track 9, I've listened to it so much, I know the track. Track 9, Tolu. He's working the crowd, and he asks, "Brother, what's your name?" And the guy in the front row goes, "Tolu." And Patrice just loses it because he's like, "I cannot use that name. I hate that name." And then he goes into like this rant that you really cannot have anything in your mouth or you will choke to death, about parents, about black parents giving their kids these names that just mark them for ridicule. Of course, I've turned it into this, mark them for ridicule. That is not a funny line to say. but that type of comic, Rickles, who he is the standard for somebody who will just rip you a new one just because you're sitting there and he feels like it. But
and you're
usually
there to get ripped on.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh man, Rickles talked about me. Oh, I'm as big a star as he is tonight. But then there are a lot of comics who, have their material. They get up, they do their routine, and if you're screaming at them, it's like you're screwing up my timing. This is like a heckler with Bill Cosby. Cosby tells stories. Not that anybody would heckle Bill Cosby. I'm sure.
I got your pudding pops right here, buddy.
Yeah. Exactly. But somebody who's there to tell stories and, draw that kind of thing, or somebody who's just got a set that's memorized and they're performing her. Hecklers can really, just be a major annoyance. Somebody who's there like, okay, let's cat and mouse this. Fine. But you never know until you get that person in front of you. But yeah, bring me some hecklers, sure. I'd love that.
About having a comedy team, like you said, like having a narrative and a story, and sometimes they can bring it all back together. Just thinking about that puts me in a cold sweat. I couldn't imagine being in front of all those people and being expected to have their attention for that long.
Same here. It looks. I mean, I have this recurring nightmare where I'm on a stage and I'm expected to do something that I have no idea how to do, like play drums.
Right.
And like, I think the only thing that could make the nightmare worse would be if I was expected to do stand up, maybe in the nude. like that would make it worse. But the recurring nightmare is bad enough as it is.
Well, see, some rude evil person would say, "Well, do it nude. There's your punchline." But see, that rude evil person would
not. I'm getting bad hecklers for you now, just for that.
I'm so mean. Forgive me. You got me all riled up with the heckler thing, especially because Michelle Obama's in the news for not dealing with saying, "Look, you can talk or I can talk, but I'm not dealing with it."
I heard that she actually came off the stage and went face to face with that person. Is that true?
That is what the reports say, and the thing too that really not even the thing too the thing about that is I am personally disturbed by the retelling of it because a number of outlets, I'll just put it that way, a number of outlets have called into question Mrs. Obama's, what's the word, her own, they've called her to task for being aggressive and getting in this heckler's face, and this heckler who doesn't even warrant the heckler, I'll leave it at that, gave an interview where she expressed surprise that, you know, Mrs. Obama would dare get in her, you know, get in her face and, you know, confront her this way. And I would argue that were the first lady not an African-American woman, we would have seen much less sympathy for this heckler that we've seen, or perhaps maybe I'm the one reading all of these reports that say, how dare Michelle Obama, you know.
The ones I read made her sound like a superhero. Made Michelle sound like a superhero for being like getting right up in the heckler's face. But maybe I was reading my own emotions into it. I was really like, oh, that is so cool.
No, yeah. Frankly, I admit I completely am in agreement with those who feel so. But a tweet I sent out earlier, let me see, what did I say? I'm not that big a fan of Twitter. I'm on it, but I'm like, how do you constrain me to 140 characters? I love these big words. Anyhow, what I tweeted was, unacceptable for black women to be in any way assertive. Can't say, you won't treat me so. And then I hashtag aggressive uppity floater. you know, and
is that trending,
you know,
now?
I don't think it's trending, and it should be trending, because nobody else is called aggressive for saying you will treat me in the manner befitting my position and me. You know, even the language of she got up in her face. No, 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 no. This woman, you know, this heckler disrespected the First Lady of the U.S. at a paid event. This is not, you know, Mrs. Obama walking through the street or going to a place where you expect outside protesters. This is not the forum. And this is from the most, I am one of the most pro-First Amendment people there are. I do believe that anti-government speech is the birthright of every American. I think it's patriotic to dissent, and it's patriotic to call out your leaders. However, there is a time where that's not appropriate. Didn't anybody listen to that turn song? I mean, come on, it's 50 years old now. To everything, there's a time and a purpose. That this was not the time. To say, Mrs. Obama got in her face. It's like, no, actually, this heckler was being impolite and was ruining the event. And the First Lady said, you know what? This event will not go on if I have to deal with this. And I'm going to address the one being egregiously poorly behaved. And it's like, you know, I will argue again. If this First Lady was not an African-American woman, if this First Lady was another person who doesn't get slurred with the term angry, with the term, you know, aggressive, it would have been a whole different thing. I speak from the experience of having been so slurred myself. I'm not a shrinking violet, and there are folks that find that threatening, and there are a lot of people who feel that that requires that I be put in my place, or that I, be tagged uppity and, you know, whatever. And I say, thank you. If you think I'm uppity, you sold me short, because I'm so much more than uppity.
I just love the idea that from now on, when somebody wants to protest the First Lady at an event, they have to wonder whether she's going to get in their face. I love that. I mean, I don't know. I feel like if you're going to be out there being like, hey, all eyes on me. I know you paid to see the First Lady, but I'm going to be rude and not everyone listen to me for a second. I don't know. I think you should feel like that you might possibly have to deal with an actual confrontation, not physical, but like an actual, you know, because you're making it personal at that point. You're making it about you. I feel like you should. you should feel like you're taking a risk there.
A week and a half ago or so, when Barack Obama was giving a speech at a college.
Yeah, he's so laid back about it. He's like, oh, just wait a second. It'll all be. I'm going to talk about that.
Yeah. And she just goes on and on and on. I thought the security would take her away, and he just kind of. He just sits there, and he's like, well, I'll get to that, but okay. And he just sits there and lets her speak. It was incredible. I don't know. Maybe he will get heckled again, but...
Yeah, I don't think Michelle Obama's going to have to deal with as many hecklers in the future, honestly.
We'll see. There will be many more stories to tell, I am certain.
Yeah.
So how are you Oklahomans doing? I mean, you know, I know you're not praying, so...
Well, we didn't get hit up here... Yeah, where I live. Chaz, did you guys suffer any damage down there?
No, but we ran because it was tracking our way down I-40, but we took off. It was mostly flooding. And actually, I got to tell you, the flooding is the worst because insurance will cover everybody who's a homeowner and got
hit
by tornadoes.
Flood insurance is a separate thing, yeah.
Yeah, because unless you're in a floodplain, you're not required to buy flood insurance. So most of the people that were damaged by flooding, they're not going to have insurance that'll cover them.
Yeah. We lost a tree up here, but, you know, it's no big deal. We have firewood now. We chopped it up. I've got a serious question for you. Key and Peele, what do you think?
Oh, well, I think the cancellation of Mad TV was a travesty.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think that, Mad TV gave this country some of its finest comic skits on television. And I was overjoyed to see Key and Peele get a show where they could kind of do their thing. I think that the show, I think that were I to be extended an invitation to come write for them, I would tell you that I wasn't a journalist anymore. I think they're brilliant. I love what they do. Let's be real. The country has been mourning the loss of Dave Chappelle from the airwaves since he left. And Chappelle, I don't think anybody would quibble with me when I say, you know, he was indeed the heir, not even the heir apparent. He was the heir to the bastard love childness of Richard Pryor and George Carlin. Chappelle really looked at race and looked at modern society and culture in such a way that everybody had to laugh about the absurdities under which we live, with which we live. But I like under which we live too. And Key and Peele is an approximation of that. I think having a black and white president in the White House, and then having two comedians who are both black and white, virtually mixed, whatever the hell that means in this modern day where everybody is mixed with everything. but it captures a certain point in this nation, and they are a pair of really funny guys, and yeah.
I couldn't believe that they made that video for Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
I can't quit you.
Video.
I know. Jay Lynch, who knew he sang? I mean,
yeah.
And that is a great Tina Marie impression if ever there was one. super hilarious. I loved that too. That was fun. I don't know if the tune is catchy enough that people will be singing the song, but absolutely that skit is primo.
Well, that's one of the things that our movement is missing, and Damien and I have talked about it privately and probably on this show, is that we don't have we have a lot of science, you know, we have a lot of philosophers. Well, we don't have a lot of appeal in the comedian world or in just the arts world as much.
Or in journalism. Like,
or in journalism, yeah.
Like, the atheist speaker circuit is lacking in all of those things.
Well, there are a lot. I am not alone. I'm not alone. There are, you've had a lot of atheists, journalists, Cenk Uygur, Young Turks, Andy Rooney. Okay, he's not with us anymore. Jack Germont, who was a legend, who's up there. I mean, a lot of reporters really don't buy religion, but they're writing for publishers who do. They're writing for communities that do. And so they really may not have the luxury that I do to just be, you know, like, it's all foolishness. Get that out of here. I don't need your woo-woo. I say that, and you know, and if people don't tune into me, well, people don't tune into me, whatever. The problem is that there are a lot of reporters who are like many of our brethren in other fields. You know, they're closeted. They can't come out. They can't let, you know, they can't let their employers know that they're really tired of, you know, making the church page, you know, so pretty every week and putting all that content on there. But it is now there. I'm unlike my radio or former radio, I don't even know, predecessor would be a good one, Wendy Williams. I am not one who will ever out unless there's a reason. There are people I know who have told me, yeah, I don't believe any of this, but you know, you know how it is. And I do know how it is. And you'd be surprised, because there are a lot of people talk about how blessed they are and, you know, have a blessed day and this, that, the other, that are probably in fear more heathen than am I. And I'm pretty heathen. We do have a lot of comedy. Modern comedy is full of raging atheists. And even if there are people who say things like, well, there's got to be a God, there's something out there, I don't believe in any man-made religion, or, you know, you have a lot of those people who are doing comedy, because frankly, religion is really easy to make fun of. And if you come from a religious background, you've got a lot of ready-made jokes. I mean, if you're into one of those religious organizations where people fall out and convulse on the floor and speak in tongues, that's scary, or that's funny. And if you tell that story in a place where people understand that, you've got an audience that's with you. You know, you can make that group of people cohesive over what you're saying and how you're saying it. Even when you look at some of the Christian comedians, you know, and that's a big thing, because a lot, you know, there are some people who just, for whatever reason, they're not into the very blue humor, and that's cool, and I kind of like that, because my journalism training is such that I can't swear if I know there's a mic around. It's really funny, and it's really weird. It's a reflex. You go to like a family friendly comedian or a Christian comedy show. There is a sizable percentage of that material that could be told in front of an atheist crowd.
I've been to those shows, man. I've never been so close to wanting to off myself.
Well, yeah, but the problem is that much like Christian rock, and there are always exceptions. If you're the exception, I'm not talking about you. But a lot of those comics are not funny. And here's the thing. Like, I come, when I was like actively doing comedy and actively writing comedy, the advantage that I had is that I'm a journalist. I'm good at telling stories, but I'm an editor, and I'm an editor who writes for radio. Radio writing is really difficult to learn because it is so succinct. I've got 40 seconds to explain to you why Congress didn't pass a piece of legislation that directly impacts your jurisdiction, in which fewer people will be able to afford their homes because of this particular provision that only affects folks in a floodplain. I've got 40 seconds to make that plain to you. And I've got to do it while you're in the car bitching at your kids in the back seat, and some idiots just cut you off.
How'd you know about my car?
But I'm good at what I do, and I can do that. So when it's like, okay, I'm going to tell a joke, I know how to get down to, okay, here's the meat of it, here's the nugget of it. Not to say that I don't need work or, oh, I'm so great because I've written a little bit. But I understand structure. So when I go to a comedy show and you see people who are amateurs, and the only reason that they're all there at one time is because, it's Christian comedy night or something. You see a lot of the same premises. You hear a lot of the same things. You know they're going to talk about Sister Lulu falling out. You know they're going to talk about Pastor such and such, and the way he gets when the spirit gets up there, and then he goes, ooh, like Little Richard. And that kind of, ooh. And it's like, well, that, yeah, but I saw that coming. Yeah, but that ain't really a joke. Now, not everybody can be Rich Little, and there are some people who can be Rich Little, or, Rich Little was very good at that. So if you're doing an impression of someone and it's spot on and everybody knows it, fine, that's great. But you're probably only going to be doing church-based comedy then. But again, back to the point is that a lot of that comedy is just not funny. You see it with a comic like, again, let's say Louis C.K., who talks about race, talks about having white daughters, talks about, and Louis is actually Latino. He's Mexican, but he has red hair and white skin.
Yeah.
So people don't assume, people don't assume that he's illegal and should be beaten for no reason. So the way he looks at the world and the way he looks at the way his daughters, who look like the majority, and the way he is treated because he looks like the majority, but he realizes, his heritage is such that, he is not the majority. The comedy he tells and the jokes that he tells, I think they are funny because they are not the jokes that everybody else is telling. There's an originality and there's a voice. And that is the thing that, that's the thing you got to have as a comic. One of the things you got to have as a comic, I did it for a while and I was good, but I was not great. And clearly I did not get a sitcom deal. but there are some things that translate, being able to write well, being able to convey an idea to distracted people of all types, is a skill that you can very well, work with. Who knows what would have happened if I decided to get serious and I'm really going to give, and I'm really going to give this comedy thing a try. There are a number of friends of mine, who are starting to get some really awesome breaks, and I'm very proud of them. And maybe one day they'll do my show, even though I'm nowhere near on the level they are anymore. But, it's good to be able to say, hey, I used to sit in the back of the room with her and wait for our names to be called at open mic. And now she's on Ellen.
Pretty cool.
There are a lot of comics who are atheists, and there are quite a few that will take shots at organized religion. You don't have to be an atheist to do that. It's really fun to do. But there are very few that are actively involved with secularism as a movement. I mean, there's you, and there's Julia Sweeney, and I've just run out of people.
Ken Jillette.
Okay, yeah.
Paul Provenza.
Paul Provenza, yeah.
All right.
There is... Now, you make a good point, and I'm going to throw out Doug Stanhope for two reasons. Number one, he is the sweetest, most awesome guy, and I love him. His comedy is dark and wicked and hilarious.
So great.
Yeah.
And he was so gracious. He's going to be on my show next week. He was awesome. He made a point of saying, the idea of, getting involved in a movement that's like, oh yeah, aren't we so smart? Aren't we smarter than other people? And he said, I don't have any interest in that. But he just raised six figures for, you know, Rebecca Vissman, or as I call her, Wolf Blitzer's friend. you know, and I don't want to put words in the mouth in the man's mouth or speak for him, but there are a lot of people and comedians included who say, why would I get together and have a meeting about what I don't believe in? Like, why do I want to sit around and listen to the 118 reasons why there are no chupacabra? Sounds really familiar to me, because that's something that some of the social justice-minded folks that I interact with, who are also atheists, have said. Doug went on a very, very profound tear about, there are people who need help. There are people who could use your support. And if you're going to, you know, if all you want to do is sit around and be, you know, be so smart about everything and, you know, why you're awesome, that's not attractive to me. And unfortunately, that is the idea that people have had about what it is that we heathen people do at our conventions and whatnot. I know for a fact that's not what we heathen people do at our conventions.
Right.
We talk about, every time you hear me, I'm going to talk about something that your Congress is doing that you might know about or you might not know about. But, you know, my job is to know what's going on up on Capitol Hill, and I talk about that. And I talk about that in a way that says, hey, you who don't want people voting on legislation because they believe that Jesus is going to come and rescue you, you need to know that your legislators are doing this. You need to know that your president is making it so that this particular group can do this or cannot do that. And so that's important. Also, frankly, I need a better word. Help me. Be my thesaurus. What's another word for fellowship?
Community?
Community. Yeah, like I cannot take my kids to an event without being vigilant about somebody giving him, and he can't, he's just starting to read. I mean, he's just starting to read. So, you know, I have had people try and give my kid Chick Tracks. I've had, you know, I keep my kid away from those stupid talking vegetables, you know, that those Christian conservative vegetables that teach you to obey and submit. I'm like, no, that's what they told slaves to do, honey. Yes, see, I don't even say the name. I just call them those stupid Christian conservatives talking vegetables. No. You say it. Feel free. I am not one to censor. It's your show. But,
I've watched quite a few of the VeggieTales. They're actually fairly entertaining by kids show standards.
That's how they get you.
Oh, you know what? You know what else they do? I got to tell you this about VeggieTales. They Baudelaireize the shit out of the Bible. So they'll have some story where, like, King David gets this guy killed so he can screw his wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the real story in the Bible. And they take that story and they make it into a friendly little kid's tale, which has nothing to do with murder and war. I'm just saying.
And the adultery that you're not supposed to have, you know.
Right. They don't have the adultery. They don't have the murder. They take all the really nasty bits out and they make it into this happy little kid's tale. And that, to me, is hilarious.
Yeah, the story that I'll just leave it at this. I love telling the Lot story. There's been one time where I was actually forced to tell a Bible story, and I said, I don't want to tell a Bible story. How about I, you know, do a Greek myth or some fun? He came to her in a shower of golden rain. No, that's fake. Oh, so the angel came upon her, and then she was with child. Yeah, okay, that's different. Really, it is. But when in doubt, tell the kids the story of Lot and his daughters. Well, that's not appropriate, and I can't think of anything else. You know, I mean, these were innocent babies, pregnant women, abortions all over Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, they all got leveled. Come on, you know. killing unborn babies is wrong unless it's Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, because they grow up and be gay or something. But Lot is the most righteous man. So let's look at parenting from Lot's perspective. Oh, you don't want me to talk about that with your kids? Okay. Yeah, so now I don't get invited there anymore. That's cool.
I can see how Lot's daughters were pissed off at him, though. I mean, he did offer them to a crowd of sodomite rapists earlier that week.
I have daughters who have not known men.
Yeah, exactly. Take my daughters. They're virgins.
Mm-hmm. Because the worth of a woman is her virginity. Here's an awful segue. When Elizabeth Smart was in the news a month ago or so, talking about she didn't feel like she was worthy of saved in term, not in the spiritual saved, that's whatever that means, she didn't feel compelled to run from her kidnappers and rapists because she was that chewed up piece of gum that the abstinence only educators like to pass around. Her worth was taken from her against her will, and you know, she was no longer pure or worthy. And you know, that's a message that I really, really hope that I don't think, contrary to what some would have you believe, I really don't think that most religious people are bad or evil or wrong. Well, they're wrong in terms of, you know, again, the debater in me. If you don't have the facts, I win the point. But I think that a lot of these people are hoping earnestly that their children are cared for and their adherence to these biblical values are going to protect them and keep their family safe and healthy. But I really hope that some of them listen to not just Elizabeth Smart, but Elizabeth Smart and some of the other people who understand that way of thinking and that way of training up one's child. Because when we look at the rate of violence against women, violence against young boys too, and older ones, there's too much violence against people. There's too much sexual violence against people. I'm talking about girls right now because people tend to equate the virginity of a female with her worth. And when you do that, if your daughter or your sister or yourself or your mother is ever put in a position where she is sexually violated, which is not beyond the realm of possibility in this world we live in, if she believes that her value as a human being has been taken from her, she's in a much harder position to be than someone who isn't carrying that weight of that emotional, mental weight of, you know, I have committed a sin. I am culpable in this. It's real easy for Americans, many of them, to look at those barbarians who would stone a raped girl, those barbarians who would, you know, would flog a woman who was having sex with somebody she wasn't married to. How dare they? But we don't do that in this culture, but what we do is we slut shame. And we say, oh, those poor boys who raped that girl in Steubenville, they didn't beat her. I mean, she didn't even really remember it. She didn't know what happened until it showed up on every cell phone in the tri-state area. You know, it wasn't that bad. I mean, you know, why did she drink? What was she doing there? What did she think would happen? You know, no, those aren't physical stones, and no, they don't kill a woman, but we need to look at the fact that there are the fate of girls who have committed suicide after their rape were bragged about on social media. And we need to look at, and it's not just in the age of social media. There are people who have been violated, and then they act out in self-destructive ways, and they put themselves in similar positions again. And, you know, I would argue that having that religious cudgel knocked theoretically upon her head, telling her, you are no longer pure, you are worthless. You're not a virgin, no man who's worthy will want you. You've already done it once. What's the harm in anything else? I mean, you gave up your worth. When we stop allowing that to be imprinted onto the brains of these young people, I think we're going to evolve and advance a bit as a world, as a culture. We also, and this is not just a girl issue, this is, we need to be teaching our sons this. Absolutely, I'm going to teach my boy this, and we need to, but we don't talk about sex in this culture. We certainly don't think about it. We just kind of admit that it happens, sort of thing.
Yeah, we had a talk about this with one of the other Free OK speakers a couple episodes ago. She's a sex educator. And we talked about this very problem about how, you know, we're not willing to talk about it openly and honestly to our children here.
Well, I think what you're saying there is like a what you would call a positive approach, because, you know, a lot of people think about atheism, they think of, you know, just it's cavernous, it's empty. There's nothing positive about the approach whenever you adopt atheism. But you're saying that this is not emotionally devastating for someone. It can actually be a way of freeing you and being able to place the blame where it properly should be, not on yourself, but on the person who's the victimizer.
Right. You know, yeah. The feeling of victimization, I would argue, you know, and I certainly don't claim to be speaking for anyone in particular. I am positing a bit. But when one believes that an event has happened which has severed her relationship with her God, with her reason to be, with the thing, the person, the entity, that gets her life meaning and purpose. When that is gone, there are psychological ramifications that happen with that. And again, I want to point to Elizabeth Smart explaining that she felt desolate, if this thing has happened to me and I have no worth and I have no meaning and I also have no relation, or maybe not no relationship with God, but I have even letting this thing happen to me has displeased the God that I live for and serve. That's an incredibly hurtful place to be, on top of the trauma that you suffered. And we can eliminate that trauma by not teaching girls and boys too, but not teaching people your value is in this virginity thing. Look at the statistics. People are getting married so much older now. You know, when no sex before marriage law was, people had a life expectancy in the 40s. They're getting married at 15 and 16. I can see why no premarital sex at 12 is maybe not a bad idea. Wait
yeah.
3 years and then she's your wife. You know, but when we realize that, you know, the age of marriage for most women is creeping into the late 20s and early 30s for men, no premarital sex through your hottest and most fun years. I mean, none of those late teens. None of that early 20s. What? that makes no sense. It really makes no sense for value. So what it does is it pushes people to either get married younger or, you know, have guilt about normal sexual expression, you know. And it's just, guilt is a bad thing. I'm all for less guilt.
Yeah, I can totally relate to the married younger thing. We do that here. We do that here in Oklahoma. People are they have these pledges, you know, to wait for marriage, and then they're like, "I'm 19, I can't wait. Let's get married now.
I'm gonna listen to this boy band, and I'm gonna be pure." Yeah, okay. Yeah, and then what does the study show? You're having more oral sex, you're having more anal sex. When you do have sex, you're unprotected.
Wait, did you say more oral sex like it's a bad thing? What?
It's a bad thing if you're doing it because I believe in acting out of desire. If that's what you want to do, fine. But if you're saying, I'm going to be a virgin, so I will only have oral sex, I will only have anal sex, and I'm not going to carry condoms because that's impending to commit the sin.
That's
so I'm going to put myself at risk for pregnancy and at risk for disease because... Well, you know, to take the assertive path towards protecting myself and my partner, you know, that only a loose woman, only somebody, some sinner would do that. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, get over it. Come on, you know, all of the training, all of the teaching, all of the finger wagging and tongue clicking has not stopped people from, you know, doing the horizontal limbo or lumbata or whatever that Spanish dance that I can't even do was. But, you know, people are going to do it, and they do. And only somebody who is incapable of accepting facts, you know, but, you look at the sex ed standards, which don't exist in most of the country, and you realize, yeah, most people can't admit that, you know. But I think we should just ask Sarah Palin how that abstinence only thing worked out for her and her kids. Cause,
it worked out. She's a grandma now. That was the goal.
Yeah.
So there's so many things that you're involved in, so many things that you do. All the other speakers in the lineup, I have a pretty good idea ahead of time what they're going to talk about.
Oh, that's probably because I've been remiss in giving my giving my topic. It'll be a surprise to us all.
Oh,
no, I'm absolutely going to talk about something political, and I cover Congress, so I love to kind of see what they're doing and newsy it up. I had the experience. I love Hemant Mehta. I think he's awesome, the friendly atheist out of Chicago.
Yeah.
Great guy. I had the experience of sitting in the crowd once while he gave the speech that I was going to give. He would have had no way of knowing what I was going to say, but he talked about how to be more appealing to journalists. He talked about all of the things that I think a journalist would stand up in front of a crowd and say.
Right.
And so it was like, oh, now that him has given Jamila a speech, now here's Jamila. And I'm like, hi, everyone. You know, yeah. So after that experience, I just kind of am like, okay, I've got a few things written, and we'll see what's happening in the news. I'll see what other speakers are going to do, and then I'm going to come up. But you know what? At 3OK, I'm the first speaker out of the gate.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of get to do whatever I want.
If you want, we can scoop you on what the other speakers are going to talk about so that you can do that to them.
Make them sweat.
Oh. Yeah, I'll be like, oh, yes, here's the sex and sexuality talk.
You could totally do that to Emily. It'd be terrible.
Soon enough, we will know.
Well, I'm excited to hear it. I'm excited to get to meet you. There's so many really more things I want to ask you about. We have a question we ask all of our guests. Have you ever had a really uncomfortable experience in an elevator?
Oh, was that the woman who thought I was my kid's nanny?
Yes, my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I'm like, I do. Yeah, even now, like that really hurt my feelings. Well, now I know I'm part Maori, but to the un-DNA tested I'm an African American. I am delighted to be so. I like me. I make no apologies for that. And I was probably, I don't remember if he was in a stroller or if he was like in a baby carrier on my back or something, but my very young child at the time, my pre-verbal child, and I were interacting. I was probably, you know, singing to him, and he was probably singing back, very much like if you've seen Gizmo, how Billy and Gremlins, how Billy and Gizmo were interacting. Billy played a song and Gizmo took it back with the keyboard, and it was really cute. So I'd do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this woman, out of the blue asked me, oh, are you looking for work? And I'm thinking, hey, people know me. Yeah, journalist looking for work. You know, and then she's like complimenting, oh, you're so good with them. Are you looking for work? And I'm thinking, of course. You know, and then it occurs to me, like, and she never even said, like, but I realized I am black. My kid, who is also black, has very light skin and has curly light-colored hair. If you don't know, you could probably mistake my child for a Caucasian child. His dad is. He's, you know, he's Caucasian, too, part. And so I realized she's saying, oh, hey, you know, let me pay you to be loving and caring and, you know, not screamy at a child with a kid I care about. And then I just, you know, it really did hurt my feelings because I felt like, what, I can't make a good looking child? Or if in your opinion, you think that if I were to have a child, I would be swearing at him and screaming at him and being unpleasant toward him. And that's really sad because, frankly, most parents are, you know, fair to middling, if not into the good range. I would think that it's more an anomaly that, like, you would see somebody who's not being loving and well behaved with their child. So clearly, you know, the kid that I worked on really, really hard wasn't mine. So yeah, that was my pleasant elevator experience.
Terrible. That is so terrible.
Oh yeah, but yeah, elevators. I need to take the stairs more.
You need to what? Take the stairs more?
I need to take the stairs more.
That's a lesson the whole free thought community can get behind. Take the stairs.
Take the stairs.
Chaz, you got anything else? Yeah.
No, I think we've stolen enough of your time. Thank you very much for coming on here.
Yeah, you've been great. The sound quality is not going to be that great, but the substance is fabulous, and I'll clean it up as best as I can.
Yeah.
Awesome. It's been fun for me, and as you see, I talk way too much. Now I'm going to take my ass to sleep so I can get up in the morning and go up on the hill and see what our Congress is doing.
Oh, man. Next time we'll talk more about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I bet they're up to no good.
Sometimes they do good. You were right when you said what you just said. So there we go. All right. You be well, good gentlemen, and I will see you soon.
Thank you so much,
Bella.
All right.
All right, you be well.
Have a great night. Bye.
The Oklahoma Atheists Godcast is produced by the Oklahoma Atheists. The mission of the Oklahoma Atheists is to develop a community of individuals and families who value and promote critical thinking, free thought, reason, and a scientific worldview, and who seek to have a positive effect on the community at large through fellowship, rational discussion, community service, and education. For more information, please visit our website at www.oklahomaatheist.com. The music for today's show is from the song God is Dead by Jaron Lake, and is reproduced here under a Creative Commons license. Jared's music and the Oklahoma Atheist Godcast are hosted courtesy of the Internet Archives Community Audio Collection, available at www.archive.org. org. To join discussion about the ideas presented in today's show, please visit our blog at blog.oklahomaatheists.com.